I first encountered the what we could call a taboo in polite circles, which includes academia, of talking at all about Zionist power and influence. About 25 years ago, I was invited to be a founding member of a board, editorial board of a new magazine. It's called Democracy. It was set up by Sheldon Wolin of the University of California. And we're sitting around that first board meeting, and this is supposed to be leading left intellectuals in the United States. That's what this journal magazine was supposed to be about. And at the end of the meeting, people said, we're going to need more people on the board. So does anyone have suggestions? I was teaching at MIT at the time, and I suggested my colleague Noam Chomsky. And it was like I farted. And I didn't quite understand what happened, because Chomsky, of course, was recognized as perhaps the leading intellectual in the United States. And the discussion just stopped. Some people sort of winced, and then they went on. Okay. Now, of course, what had happened, and I was naive in a sense because I didn't understand this, was that Chomsky was beyond the pale already 25 years ago. This was 1981 or so, because he had had the temerity to raise questions about Israel, Zionism, etc. And so here was this left intellectual journal, which was just setting up to counter some of the right-wing journals that had been established in the Reagan era. And among them, among the progressive, self-described radical intelligentsia, Chomsky was beyond the pale. That has remained the case. And anyone in the academy in North America who dares to raise these questions, and it doesn't matter if they're Jewish, I mean, Dan's Jewish, I'm Jewish, Noam's Jewish, okay, we are called anti-Semites along with everyone else. As soon as you do it, you're silenced, you're isolated. And not only isolated by the people you would expect to flee from you, but you're isolated from the people you thought were your friends. And I'm starting off just talking about the left, which has a pretty bad record here. This is a taboo subject. Now, in Canada, this has become even more so, as Dan mentioned, and some other speakers mentioned CEJA. In 2002, because of the demonstrations against Netanyahu in Concordia, the Zionist establishment, Heather Reitzman, Jerry Schwartz, and their friends, very rich, very powerful, very influential people, said, our friend Netanyahu has just been humiliated. We got to do something about it. And they resolved to redouble the Israel advocacy effort in Canada, doubling the funds and fundamentally reorganizing the entire Israel lobby. And they set up CEJA, the Canadian Council for Israel and Jewish Advocacy, as the main instrument for doing that. Some of the other speakers have talked about the successes. The lobbying effort has essentially two sides and their corollaries. One is to advocate on behalf of Israel, and the reverse side is to hammer, smash any dissent. And as Dan just suggested, and we've both experienced firsthand, anti-Semitism is the weapon of choice. So in recent years, we've seen a change in Canadian policy at the top, votes in the UN, most recent decision even in advance of the US regarding Hamas, suppression of dissent, books, plays, radio broadcasts, repression of students, professors, and the like. We're all quite familiar with this. What I want to emphasize in just a minute or two is that the campus is a very important locus of this activity. Precisely because it was the Concordia incident, that is at a university campus, that provoked the reorganization. The campus has been a very, very important target of both advocacy and suppression of dissent. So the CEJA has set up various organizations, the National Center for Jewish Campus Life, They've set up and hired organizers whom they sent all over the country to develop cadre on the campuses, student government, student newspapers, et cetera, recruit people, and send people on missions, as they call them, to Israel, students, as well as many others, police, politicians. We're going to hear from Jamila about the police. And this is an ongoing, very well-funded, and remarkably well-organized campaign. At York, they were successful in electing a Zionist slate to the student government. They pretty much control the student newspaper for the last several years. The president went on her own mission to Israel, together with a number of her top administrators, all funded by Julia Koschitzky and Jerry Schwartz, the CIJA folks. And again, the reverse side, they have been very insistent on suppressing any and all dissent. I first met Dan, I was on sabbatical, and I read in the paper that the president had summarily, unilaterally suspended him and banned him for 3 years for using a megaphone or something like that. I read about it in the paper, so I immediately called his lawyer, whose name was in the paper, and hired Dan as my research assistant, requiring that he use my office in the library in order to defy the ban. And within days, the university came down on me. At that point, I started to investigate, and I've done a lot of this sort of thing, investigating boards and stuff, and started investigating where this was all coming from at York. And it turns out there's an organization called the York University Foundation, set up the same year as CIJA, and that there was a very high density of Israel lobbyists and fundraisers on the board of the York University Foundation. And so I issued a flyer, a two-page flyer, just handed it out to my students, suggesting, among other things, that the presence of these Israel lobbyists had something to do with the repression on campus, the banning of Dan, a clampdown on free speech and assembly, etc. I handed it out at around 6 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, and less than 24 hours later, 5 o'clock on Friday, I got a call from the Globe and Mail. They had received press releases from the president of my university, from the Canadian Jewish Congress, condemning me as an anti-Semite, a bigot, etc., which the Globe and Mail reporter dropped whatever she was doing at 5 o'clock on Friday and ran the next morning the Saturday Globe, and then the Star ran the next day. Well, that seemed to confirm my hypothesis that the Israel lobby had a remarkable influence. So I sued them for $10 million, that is the university, for defamation. $10 million. Which would replace the Canadian contribution to the Palestinian Authority when I win. And in the process, we're in arbitration now, I was able to obtain a document which I've distributed some copies of. And it's a document, a fax from Hillel of Greater Toronto, from people who are on the payroll of the Israel lobby to some of the officials at York University. This is hours after I handed out my leaflet, saying, let's get them, the smoking gun. Now, on Wednesday, this past Wednesday, York went to the arbitration and tried to get the arbitrator to order me to be gagged, to silence me from even talking about this, that is, to silence me from talking about what I'm talking about now. The arbitrator hasn't yet ruled, so I'm still talking. But the fact that the university, at the behest of the lobby, is doing this is testimony to what we're talking about here. What we're also talking about is universities providing academic legitimacy and respectability to the Israel lobby. So what I want to suggest is that we have to fight this very vigorously to decouple the lobby from our institutions and their influence on our institutions in order to deprive them of, deny them that legitimacy, which they're using to great effect. We have a great advantage. June 10th, all the universities in Ontario, and McMaster included, will for the first time in 20 years come under the Freedom of Information Act. That's June 10th. And we should use that, again, rigorously to find out what's going on our campuses. Let me just close with another point, which I hope we can talk about. Khaled Muammar raised it. I talked to him about it. And it's about the general theme of this conference, which is Israel apartheid. And the more I listened, the more I began to wonder whether the apartheid analogy is perhaps too weak. The Afrikaner government never enjoyed anything like the legitimacy of the Israeli government. And the reason, I believe, and this is what my book, Beyond the Promised Land, tries to address, is that the Zionist project is rooted in the foundational myth of our society, the Abrahamic myth of the Old Testament, the myth of the Promised Land, the myth of the chosen people. The support of Israel by Western powers, just as including God's new Israel, now it's called the United States, is rooted in this shared mythology. And so the question I just want to leave you with is this. Is it really possible for us to succeed in our struggle without confronting and coming to grips with this whole mythology of chosen people, promised land, that is to rethink our biblical heritage? Thank you.